You know, I'm not sure that I agree at all with our Fast Blaster, who suggests that somebody told us something like, all these planetary bodies are yours, but stay off the moon, you know, or something similar. Not that I believe that, mind you, but we have done so very little since we did go to the moon. It's almost like you could believe something like that. And I know a lot of people do. Chip, you're probably not one of them, are you? You don't suppose we were greeted by somebody who said, don't you come back here now?
No, I don't believe that.
All right, well, look, it's been all these years, decades, actually. So what the hell happened?
Actually, somebody did say it. It was Ho Chi Minh, I believe.
Ho Chi Minh. Well,
yeah, we spent the money in that war in Vietnam. So we didn't have the money to go on the moon. And actually, there was a secret military, two secret military plans to go to the moon, three counting the Russians.
Military plans.
Military plans.
I take it wasn't to collect helium-3. The military probably had something else in mind.
They wanted to base nuclear weapons on the moon.
Yeah, there's our military.
Now, this Project Horizon there was an Air Force one and an Army one, and the reason was during the our Cold War with the Russians, when we had bombers carrying nukes, it took hours or you know, a long time to get to the target.
Yes.
When we transitioned to ICBMs, it was a question of minutes. So first strikes became something that could be thought of.
Well, I know, but how does it help to have nuclear weapons and missiles on the moon? That's 2.5 days.
That's right. So if you have weapons on the moon, you wipe out the U.S. with a first strike. Even if you do, you can't wipe out the moon. You can't launch things to the moon without being seen, and you need 2.5 days to get there. So no matter what happens on Earth, you'd have a retaliatory strike coming from the moon. And that was the theory.
I see.
Now,
so when we've thrown everything we have from Earth, then we can...
Right.
If there's anybody left, they can push the final button, and that launches from the moon.
Right. Well, theoretically, this would keep you from launching a first strike, knowing that no matter what, you would get hit by the retaliatory strike. Now, that seemed to make sense to these guys in around 1959. Then Admiral Rickover came up with the idea of nuclear subs. They can hide, and you can't be assured of finding all of them after first strike.
That's so right. Same effect, less cost.
Same effect, less cost. And then the military said, well, then we don't have to go there.
Mm.
Then there was, we had beaten the Russians. Kennedy was dead. We were in a tremendously costly war in Vietnam that took everything that we had.
It did.
And the main Russian, who was the father of the Russian space initiative, Korolev, also suddenly died. Khrushchev was deposed, and the Russians' space initiative went dormant. So there was no real reason to keep beating the Russians. We'd beaten them, we'd shown the flag, and people basically lost interest, although NASA went on at $13 billion a year for the last 40 years, trying to come up with some other reasons to exist, which they successfully did. But colonizing the moon and having a base there, a continual base, was seen as too expensive, and there was no real reason to do it at that time.
Is helium-3 the reason?
They hadn't realized about helium-3, but it is one of the reasons.
No, 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 no. Is it the reason now?
Yes. Helium-3 and lunar solar power. Now to...
Lunar solar power. Explain that one.
Well, when we know that getting things to orbit is too costly, then we look at for a stable platform for our solar panels up there. And the moon is that stable platform. The moon, the surface of the moon, the regolith again, has everything you need to build solar panels. In other words, it's 40% oxygen by weight. It has iron, titanium, silicon, the noble gases, everything you need to do to build solar panels, build microwave repeaters, and...
And you think it would be reasonable to microwave that power back from the moon to Earth? Would that be would it be economically feasible, technically feasible, and then economically feasible?
Yes. In fact, there's a very intelligent scientist, David Criswell, at the University of Houston, who's been working on the problem for the last 20 years or so, has done all the engineering data and has come up with a very compelling paper, which is included both in my site and in the DVD.
All right. And you're making the case, what, that solar power in orbit, in the long run is not economically nor scientifically feasible because things would hit it? The amount of junk after a while that we'd have up there would be overwhelming to the point that it would make it not practical?
Well, it's one concern. Now, there's ways around it, a space junk man, space vacuum cleaner, something to keep cleaning it up.
Yes.
But it would be continually degrading. But the main problem is, the cost to orbit at $10,000 a kilo. That's coming down, but only as private enterprise gets into it, like Elon Musk and his rocket and Rutan and their ways to try to get into orbit. The space elevator may be the answer.
Yes. You want to go ahead and explain that concept?
Okay. It's like if you spin a ball around your head, it's held taut because of centrifugal force.
Right.
Well, the same thing. A Russian, Tsiolkovsky, came up with this idea in 1885 or so. And then Art Sutinov did, and then Arthur C. Clarke wrote Fountains of Paradise with this idea in mind. You need something that's 50 times stronger than steel in linear strength.
That would come from the nano
carbon
world.
Nanotubes,
yes.
Buckyballs expressed as carbon, long carbon tubes put together in a ribbon, and then you send a mechanical climber up and down, adding more ribbons as you go until you can. Now, mechanically, you're sending things into space, so you're not taking a big tank full of fuel, and you're getting power from the ground by hitting it with lasers that are transformed into kinetic energy and drive the mechanical shuttles up and down the elevator.
Huh.
So using this, you can bring cost to orbit down to something closer to $100 a kilo to orbit. Now things start getting doable as far as putting a lot of stuff up into space, including people.
Very very doable. I love the idea of a space elevator or, a freight elevator in essence.
Right.
To take things up at a very inexpensive price. But how realistic is it? I've interviewed people in the nano world, and they seem to really feel that not only is it possible, but it's in the near term that we could come up with this substance in the near term.
Yes.
You agree with that?
Yeah. Brad Edwards is a friend of mine. He's working on it. He's raising money for it right now. He's got a company called Carbon Designs. They've been doing the work. They've been, I think they have carbon nanotubes maybe feet long at this point. Problem is, you need 62,000
I know
miles.
But even if they're out to feet, that's from the nano world a
yes.
pretty big jump. This would be an elevator, folks, right from the ground. I assume, Chip, that it would probably be at the equator. Would it be?
It's yes. The equator gives you the proper area. Where they're looking at is right by that earthquake they just had. They're looking at the sea. Off the west coast of South America, because that's the place with the fewest storms and has the best weather. It would be at sea so they could move it around in case of storms, anchored to something akin to a giant oil platform that floats and moves.
But this would be a true Jack and the Beanstalk kind of actual physical elevator all the way through the atmosphere
right
to the other side, all the way up potentially to geosync locations
and
beyond.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things you could do is not stop and just let it fling you out to the moon or any other body at great speed and low cost. So you would send a You'd send, first of all, rockets up to geosynchronous, and then you would reel it out using a counterweight.
Okay, so this elevator would be built from geosynchronous, 22,300 miles or so up, and it would be built down to the Earth, dropping
right.
through the atmosphere, dropping through whatever storms might be there, and eventually touching ground.
Being anchored, and then using lasers to power these mechanical devices up and down, adding more layers to it to make it stronger, and sending massive amounts of material up, and bringing things back. In other words, now we spend a lot of money. Once a satellite runs out of fuel, it's useless. It's space junk. We have to send another one up.
Correct.
Well, you could go up, grab them, bring them back down, fix them, fill them up with fuel, send them back up again. It would save a lot of money.
The whole concept is so incredible and so science fiction-y, and yet from everything I can discern, talking to the scientists, it really is possible. It's a total mind blower, but it's cool to think about, Chip. It really is.
Yeah.
When do you suppose, if you were to just take a guess as a science fiction guy, a number of years before we might actually begin such a project?
Well, it depends how defined begin, because it has begun.
All right.
There are serious people working on it.
Sure, I'll set one up for you. We have a real crisis. Since we don't do anything until we have a crisis, we suddenly have a real crisis. The price of gasoline goes unbelievably high, makes $70 a gallon look like, or a barrel look like nothing.
Right.
So then we do something. That's how we operate.
Right.
So let's say we devoted a Manhattan-style project mentality to this. How quick could we do it?
The moon or the space elevator?
The space elevator.
It would be just a guess for me. I would say within 10 years.
10 years?
Well, they are trying to raise money right now, and they're raising money in strange places. They're raising money in countries that can't afford a real space program. They can't afford rockets and the whole infrastructure and so forth, but who would love to have power beamed down to
so
them.
We're approaching countries and saying, would you like to invest in the space elevator?
Yes. Brad Edwards is.
Really?
Yes, he
and,
is.
And how is he being received?
He's being received very seriously. I've been to one of the conventions. All the NASA people seem to take them seriously. They're building an exhibit in Barcelona.
Well, actually, you know...
One in Vegas, actually.
Actually, you know, I think that NASA had the original idea. If I recall this original story, it was one of those things that came from NASA, and you went, oh, come on. Wasn't it? Wasn't it their original idea?
Well, actually, it was the Russians who came up with the original idea way back when. But that was... Tsiolkovsky was a visionary Russian who came up with a lot of the ideas that we now have. And then Art Sutinov in the 30s and 40s brought it into the modern age. And then Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book, a fictional book. And then NASA, apparently, as happens sometimes in science fiction, takes it seriously and started developing it. And I believe it was... NASA Advanced Concepts.
Yeah, just a very few years ago, it was one of those articles that they use as a tag to a newscast or something for a good laugh at the end. Ha, ha, ha,
right.
Space elevator.
Right.
Well, that was a very few years ago, and now all of a sudden, we're getting very serious about it now.
Right. Well, Brad Edwards started out at, I think, Sandia Labs, and then got a grant from the NASA NIAC, Special Projects, developed it there, and now he's taking it into the commercial area.
Hey, Chip, if I got on this elevator and pushed up, how quick, if it were built, how quickly would I arrive at a totally airless 22,300-mile point? How long would it take?
It would take a couple of days, but the view would be great.
I bet it would. Boy, talk about a photo op.
Right. You would have cocktails overlooking the entire section of the Earth as the weather passes.
That's amazing.
And it would be like the blimps, the Hindenburg, not to bring up a bad subject, but the dirigibles.
I wouldn't have picked the Hindenburg.
Right.
I don't think the
old days, rather than bouncing around in a choppy plane, you would float. And this would be the same sort of idea. You know, a rocket ship is, you know, you have to go under intense training and tremendous G-forces and stuff like this. This would be actually, it would feel like an elevator. You wouldn't feel any of that stuff until you start.
Would it, well, there's an interesting question. So at a couple of days to get there, that would mean you'd be traveling at a speed of what, roughly?
I don't know. It would take 62,000 divided by 2 or 3 days, but...
Well, somebody will do the math.
Somebody will do the math.
Very
interesting. You should have Brad Edwards on, and he can give you all the exotic details. I'm just a filmmaker here. I failed chemistry in 10th grade.
I understand. Somebody will do the math for us. It'd be interesting to know how long it would take you to get from Earth to GeoSync Point.
Right.
But you'd be traveling
at a hotel.
You'd be traveling at a pretty good clip, but not one that you couldn't stand.
No, you wouldn't, you know, it'd be like an, once it started up, I doubt that you would feel any acceleration at all. So it would be totally benign. You wouldn't have to take any astronaut training or anything like that.
Huh.
And when you get there, there would be the hotel there waiting for you and all the fun that you could have in low grav.
All the fun you could have, yes. Well, there is, of course, that aspect working on cutting down the amount of money to orbit. There's a lot of private people. Some of them are my friends who are doing work in this area.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that work? Is it going to happen? Is it going to come from somebody like Rutan? Is it going to come from these areas rather than our government? We've learned lately not to necessarily depend on the government for what they ought to do when they ought to do it.
Right. Well, that's the general feeling, and people are struggling to figure out what type of structure is going to do this. And my feeling is that when people realize how profitable it could be, in other words, you know, Queen Isabella may have launched the first ship over, but after that it was the Merchant Adventures, the Hudson Bay Company, people who thought that they, you know, the future was in beaver pelts.
Well, I've got something for you to contemplate. If we built successfully a space elevator from Earth right into GeoSync orbit, and it now looks like it might be done, what would happen if some damn fool hit it with an airplane?
It would, the top would fly up, the bottom would float gently down. There would be escape means, parachutes or whatever, for whatever mechanical means. But it wouldn't crash like a spacecraft.
It wouldn't.
No. They figure that the nanotubes would you know, float down and possibly disintegrate as they come down.
A really good idea. Until you said it would take a couple of days to reach the top. Now, let's think about it. Do we really know the long-term effects of elevator music on the human brain? Can you imagine 2 days of muskrat love? The whole idea of the space elevator is really wonderful in so many ways. One, because it appears to be actually realistic. In other words, we're not touting something that can't be. I've had guest after guest after guest, particularly from the nano world, who claim not only is it possible, but we're almost there. I know it seems incredible to imagine that, but we're almost there. I guess that's a relative term. But we are almost there. The nano world is going to produce what's needed to do this whole space elevator thing, literally from 22,300 miles right down to Earth, anchored on Earth, and then an elevator that would go up, transport people and things to orbit and beyond. So you do feel this is realistic, right, Chip?
Yes, I do. I've talked to him. I've seen the studies. I've seen the animation. It's in the video. And people are very serious about this.
Okay, it's in the video you did, right?
Yeah, and it's also Brad Edwards has his own video on it.
All right.
Carbon Designs.
Let's promo your video. Since you did it, and obviously you're here to promote the whole concept, the video takes what? From A to Z in this area, in colonizing the moon, in putting up perhaps a space elevator? All of this is in that?
Right. And also lunar solar power, helium-3. And it also goes into what it will be like when we have lunar colonies. And, you know, how we will live, what we can do on the moon, how much fun it'll be, and what a great time it'll be for everybody, both on the moon and on Earth, because it will create tremendous wealth on Earth.
All right. Look, the moon is a pretty inhospitable place. It doesn't have air.
Right.
It may have water, but that's going to have to be mined like your helium-3.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we establish a colony on the moon? Is it realistic to even try?
Well, NASA has announced that we're going back there for an extended stay. If you look at the moon, to get into this idea of inhospitable moon, if you look at the moon and you see the dark areas,
yes,
those are the maria, the lunar seas. It's not water, it's lava. There were giant impacts that then filled up with molten lava and solidified.
Yes.
In the molten lava, there are lava tubes where the lava runs down and then crusts over and then evacuates as the flow diminishes. These are called rills. It's what the Apollo astronauts went and discovered.
Yes.
They find that some of these rills are not collapsed. In other words, there are complete lava domes and rills which have lava roofs. You could burrow into them, and you have an enclosed environment.
So you're saying that perhaps the shelters already exist on the moon?
Yes, they do. And we've seen them, and we know where the ones that aren't broken are.
All right, NASA did announce they're going to go back to the moon. They said something, I think, about a couple of weeks is what I heard. Man,
to stay, yes.
Yeah, to stay 2 weeks. Now, what's the point of that? What could they do, Chip, in 2 weeks that would be valuable for mankind?
Basically demonstrate a lot of the technologies that we're going to use to stay. In other words, you know, Columbus didn't stay in America. He went, he discovered it, came back and said, "There's, you know, we think there's gold. We think there's lots of stuff we can use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's plant a flag and own it." The same way, you know, they're going to be looking at technologies that we are going to use to have a permanent place. Now, you know, the interesting thing is where will we have the first outpost? And a lot of people think it's on Malapert Mountain in the South Pole. And the reason is that as you go to the poles, you want communication with Earth, so it has to be on this side.
True.
You want constant light, because that's your power.
Right.
So at the poles, since the moon is not inclined like the Earth is,
you've got full-time sun.
It's constant.
Mm-hmm.
In the South Pole, there are large, high peaks, and the most interesting one is Malapert Mountain. And to have a base there, you would have sunlight over 90% of the time. So you would have almost continual solar power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. You would have communication with Earth. And you would be right next to constant shadow, so which is also very useful because that's extremely cold.
And there's also water there, isn't there?
They believe, and they've shown, and the both Lunar Prospector and the previous mission have shown evidence of water in the craters at the South Pole, which never get light. In other words, the light is going to boil off any water or ice that's there.
I see.
If it never hits, the ice may still be there.
Well, water would be a must. There would have to be reachable water on the moon, wouldn't there?
Yes, and there is also, it's also salted in the regolith very thinly, hydrogen and hydrogen radicals. So since the moon is 40% oxygen, which is a whole other positive thing, water is good for both breathing, drinking, growing things, and as rocket fuel. In fact, it's the best chemical rocket fuel known. So the other thing that the moon does is if you start collecting the oxygen, then you can, again, refuel all your things in orbit without having to go back down the gravity well of Earth.
Okay, so if I'm the president of the United States, Chip, but I'm not. Were I, however,
yes.
And you were trying to talk me, especially when I have domestic expenditures and I have a war going on. I've got a lot of very expensive things going on, actually, Chip. And you're going to come to me and try to talk me into the kind of money it's going to take to go to the moon and perhaps even establish a full-time presence on the moon. How are you going to convince me? Because I've got my jaw locked pretty hard right now in terms of the money I've got to spend for all this stuff we've got going wrong around here.
Right. I would say you're spending the money in the wrong place right now. We're spending $100 billion a year protecting our oil, shall we say, or grabbing oil from other areas and bringing it back home.
Yes.
We're spending apparently now $200 million and more this year on building back up what the climate change...
Oh, no, that'd be billions.
Billions.
Billion. Big difference.
So look, project that out in the future and see what you're going to be spending. Look at the going to the moon and bringing back helium-3, projecting back, microwaving back clean solar power everywhere. Now, the problems with the power is you can't store it. You can't transmit it without a cost. But if you microwave it back from the moon or from orbit, it's on time, on target. In other words, you could have a Rectenna field in a small village in Africa. You don't need a grid. You don't need anything. You need Rectennas. And it's power right there when you need it. And you can bounce it off reflectors and get it to anywhere on Earth at any time. And you don't have to store it, which is the big problem.
Can we get enough hardware, Chip, to the moon to do this kind of thing without the space elevator? Or does the cost to orbit stop us until we get the space elevator or another way to get things to space or the moon cheaply?
No, the answer is no, because you're not sending the mass of material, you're sending factories. In other words, you're sending just the engineering you need to take the in-situ resources, the stuff that's actually on the moon, and build out of that stuff what you need. In other words, you're not taking silicon or iron up there. It's there. You don't need to take it.
Right.
So you're just taking the fact, and probably, hopefully, my kid will be one of the kids now training in these video games, these plays night and day, that's going to be running the robotics and building these factories from the Earth, because we don't need as many humans as you might think.
So you think all of this can occur without necessarily the presence of human beings?
Well, human beings will be there, but they don't need to run. We don't need everybody up there running robotics when we can run them right from Earth. It's 2.25 seconds delay. So it's much cheaper to send up robotics, have a small force there to fix them and so forth until we get enough of an infrastructure there.
Okay, again, let me be clear, Chip. You're saying that the kind of technology you're talking about putting on the moon right now, we could do right now, even with the clumsy, expensive rockets we have?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, Alan Binder, who is a principal investigator of the Lunar Prospector mission, which was a mission that went for $63 million and returned a profit, which embarrassed NASA. But he suggests that we could have a lunar base in 10 years for $10 billion.
Wow.
Now, Criswell, who is the proponent of lunar solar power, said that to return lunar solar power and make it profitable, to get it up and profitable and making money, would cost in total $300 billion. That sounds like an enormous amount until you realize we just lost $200 billion in one hurricane.
Yes.
And the Department of Defense budget for a year is $300 billion.
Well, when people are doing things like this, many times they're required to put together a business plan. In other words, can you show me that for that $300 billion or whatever, we're going to end up with something that's going to be profitable in the end? That it's going to make a profit. I mean, every business model has, at the end of the day, got to show you how it's going to make money.
Right. I would just, myself, I'm not that smart, but I'll point you to Criswell. And again, it's you can Google it. It's Criswell, University of Houston. He's done a plan. He's done the engineering.
Right. All I'm asking you is, in his plan, is it profitable?
Yes. And he says, not only is it profitable, but it will make a change on the Earth comparable to the change that America went through when we got rural electricity. In other words, all of a sudden, clean solar power will up the gross national product by a tremendous amount. And I'll leave the exact figures to him. But it has tremendous effect on everything we do here, and it will be a new age, a new economic age.
Ben, in your opinion, if all of this is possible and profitable now, and God knows the Earth needs it, why aren't we doing it?
What's holding us back?
That's right.
That's a great question. I think that we have an antagonistic view of things now, and we're mired in old arguments. In other words, we have these scientists and space visionaries who are capable of doing all this and want to do it, and they're tremendously frustrated because for 40 years they thought they were working towards something and they've been frustrated. We haven't been going back. On the other hand, we have the large corporations and administration who can't see the forest for the trees, particularly, and we have the ecologists. Who you would think would embrace this, but in my experience, do not.
Why not?
All I can tell you is the Sierra Club had a big convention a couple weeks ago. I offered to go up there and have my documentary available, and the answer I got back was, no, we don't want you there.
Isn't that interesting?
We have to fix stuff on Earth before we can go to space.
They're unwilling to even consider the presentation?
Yes. And I found that...
That's odd.
I find it shocking. I find it so shocking because all we need is for these people to work together. You know, looking at the large corporations and the administration, doing this is a new frontier. It means jobs. It means technology. It means going forward. For the ecologists, you don't have to fight people. We're not fighting. You don't have to fight. It's not either or. It's that we should be doing this because it benefits everybody, and I can't see any downside to it.
Chip, they must have some rationalization already built up, apparently, about why it's a bad idea from their point of view. What is it?
All I can think of, and this is just my personal opinion, is that it threatens them because they are doing stuff in a microcosm, and the problem may be bigger than their solutions, and that may be a threat to them. I mean, the study that I keep pointing out to, Marty Hofford's study, said the problem is much bigger than people are dealing with. It's so big that passing a law, taking a congressman to lunch, trying to do something political is not going to have that much effect. We have to do something technological. And I all I can think of is that the ecological people that have these Sierra clubs and things like that don't want to look at a larger problem and don't want to look at a macro solution rather than a micro solution.
All right. Well, Bert Rutan showed us a technical feat.
Mm-hmm.
That was a step. how much more of a technical feat do we need demonstrated to begin to have faith that the private sector will do what the government apparently is unwilling to do?
That's a question that I think, you know, I'm trying to get the word out. I think if people just realize that there is hope and there is a positive thing to do, it's not a question of demonstrating any, you know, technology. I think when we go there and show that we can be on the moon again and get kids more excited about taking science and being scientists rather than being celebrities, that it will happen. Now, that's going to be, they're looking at 2018.
I have no argument with any of that. We need more people in science. We need to get people excited. But that in itself is not enough reason to do it. There's only one reason that it'll get done, and private industry will do it if it's profitable.
If it's profitable.
Everything in the world's bottom line. So if you can prove that even with today's rocketry hardware, we can get the kind of hardware on the moon we need, with robots or whatever, to beam power back to Earth and make a profit, then you're going to be able to sell this idea.
Right. I think I think that thing that you're looking at that may get people to notice this would be a Chinese Sputnik. The Chinese are very aggressive and have announced that they're going to the moon.
It's all true. They have.
India and...
But what you're telling me right now amounts to, look, if we get embarrassed, or we find ourselves in a race with somebody, then we'll do it. But see, then we're doing it because we're in a race with somebody again for a national pride thing, not for profit.
I'm not saying that's optimum. I'm saying that's what probably we'll have to have.
And I'm saying, look, why isn't profit enough of a motive by itself? Why do we have to find ourselves in an adversarial position to accomplish, as we did with the Soviet Union? We went to the moon, and we accomplished only because we were in a damn race.
Right. You're right. Profit is the motivation. I'm wondering why the giant energy companies, knowing that they're going to run out of product, aren't the ones leading the charge. Why isn't Bechtel, why isn't Halliburton, why isn't these people who have such a bad rap now, Exxon and so forth, why aren't they looking for alternate energy, and why aren't they going there and doing this?
Good question.